The Friday afternoon edition of the Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS and worldwide via the free KTRS app. You can email me, Paul, at harrisonline.com. Follow me on Twitter, at Paul Harris Show, or follow Max on Twitter, at Max on Movies. This is the time each week when Max and I turn our attention to what's opening on the big screen, what's worth your eyeballs and your money, and what you should skip, or in some cases we just say, you know what, it's not that bad, but wait for it to come on to Netflix or Amazon Prime or DVD or whatever. And there are actually three movies opening today around the St. Louis area with people in them you would recognize. And the first of the three that we're going to talk about here today is I, Tonya, which stars the beautiful Margot Robbie.
I thought you were going to say the beautiful Sebastian Stan.
He plays Jeff Galooly.
That's right, he does.
To her.
People might know him from the Marvel comics movies. He plays a Winter Soldier in those movies, but I thought he was just phenomenal as Jeff Galooly.
All right, let me get started on this because we've both seen it, and then you can jump in anytime you want. At the beginning of this movie, there are the opening credits, and then there's a title card that says, based on irony-free, wildly contradictory, and totally true interviews with Tonya Harding and Jeff Galooly. And I will tell you, I was not sure what to make of that. Is this going to be a drama? Is this going to be a comedy? Is it going to be a mix of the two? Turns out that it's what some people would describe as a dark comedy. It seems to be leaning at least more in the comedy direction. But I'll tell you, Max, I find no humor in the tale of a woman who was physically and emotionally abused from childhood by her mother and into adulthood by her husband. You may remember the 1993 Tina Turner biopic, What's mm-hmm. Love Got to Do With It, in
great
which she
movie.
Gets the crap beat out of her, Angela Bassett, gets the crap beat out of her by Lawrence Fishburne playing Ike Turner, and it didn't present itself as a comedy. And as horrific as some of those scenes are in I, Tonya, a few of them are presented in a not-so-serious way. That bothered me. Did it bother you?
Well, no, but I can detail why in just a few moments. I'm going to listen to you, though, first.
Okay, no, you can jump in on this right now.
Okay, well, I was a little concerned by this because I'd read another critic say that it was making light of domestic violence. But I think this goes back to the opening title card, saying that this is based on contradictory reports. Both her mother and her ex-husband say they never abused her. Her mother said that she slapped her
once. That's what domestic abusers always say.
I understand that, but Paul, what this movie is doing is it's playing with the nature of truth. That's why at one point, Tonya Harding, played by Margot Robbie, chases Galooly out of their apartment with a shotgun, looks at the camera, and says, this never happened. I think what they're doing is they're telling both sides of the story. Galooly says it never happened, and that's why he's sitting there as a mild-mannered person, Sebastian Stan, saying, I don't know what she's talking about, that never happened. The movie is simply presenting both of these interviewees their tales. And I think as a viewer, we can make up our own minds. Well, I'm pretty sure that her mother abused her based on what Tonya said. Her mother still says that never happened.
But in doing it that way, it comes off almost like a mockumentary. And
well, I think this tale is larger than life. The whole Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding thing was a giant media spectacle that was only eclipsed by O.J. Simpson, another giant media spectacle.
But that doesn't mean it deserves to be that the domestic violence needs to be portrayed in a humorous fashion.
Well,
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't think that
I think the director did it that way.
I think if the domestic violence was presented in a humorous fashion, we would have seen little birdies running around her head after she was hit. I think it was more telling the audience these are claims that are not that are disputed by half of the
still,
people.
Still, I'm seeing a woman get beat up by her mother and her husband on
which
screen.
The mother and husband who they interviewed for the movie
but
said
regardless of what they said,
but
I'm still
the
watching
movie.
The presentation,
okay.
And they're doing it
it's
in a comedic fashion.
I disagree. It's the movie, the title card says, this is based on contradictory interviews. I think it was an ingenious way to present these contradictory stories.
The light tone is also there in many scenes where we have voiceover narration from these characters while they're being interviewed later, but also in the middle of some scenes, they break the fourth wall, look at the camera, and now they're talking in character while they're doing narration, commenting on the scenes they themselves are in.
Yes.
I think that also lightens the tone in a story that is not all that light. I understand what you're talking about the perspective, but it bothered me. Here's something else that bothered me about this. This plays as though Tonya Harding is a victim of every circumstance in her sordid life. But like The Florida Project, a movie from last year that I hated, this is essentially a movie and I'm not just talking about Tanya, but everybody around her, this is a movie about bad people making bad choices.
Mm-hmm.
Tanya may have been a hell of a skater. She was a hell of a skater. But she's also the kind of genius who alternated drags off a cigarette with hits off her asthma inhaler.
Now, you're also saying that it presents her as a victim of everybody around her. It certainly doesn't make her a saint. This is not, because I know you were worried, in your words, about this being a propaganda movie, this being a pro-Tanya Harding movie. I don't think it makes her any kind
saint. But she doesn't take responsibility for the problems that befell her. She places blame instead on her poor upbringing and her horrible mother and her scumbag husband and the figure skating judges. Everything is somebody else's fault.
Right. Which, again, these are based on interviews with this person.
I know.
So the movie, I don't think, is asking the audience to agree with her point of view.
I think the audience will agree with her and look at her in a different light and make her look heroic.
I disagree because of the reception at the Golden Globes, which was already uncomfortable, with a lot of people saying, why wasn't Nancy Kerrigan there? Why are we applauding Tanya Harding? So just because the movie is saying, here's her point of view, I don't think the audience is going to agree with that.
Okay, well, we disagree on this.
That's fun.
I will say that Margot Robbie is nothing short of great as Tanya Harding. She gets the look and the attitude and the swagger just right. I don't know how much of the actual skating she did and how much was done by a double and CGI changed it so they can look like her.
I don't think she can do a triple axel, so it's probably CGI.
Very few women can do. In fact,
nobody had done one before.
That's not true. Oh. Tanya was the first American woman to land one in competition. Midori Ito, a Japanese skater, who I got to see at the 92 games. I'll come back to that in a second.
Nice.
She actually had done it in competition, but no American had. I'll also say that Allison Janney, who won both a Golden Globe and last night a Critics' Choice Award, does a very convincing job as Lavanna, who is Tanya's mother and who is in the running for worst parent ever.
She stabs her with a knife.
She throws the knife at her and it lands in her arm.
It's gruesome.
She's probably going to be nominated for an Oscar, and she's probably going to give Laurie Metcalf, who's the mother in Lady Bird, a run for her money, don't you think?
It's a two-woman race right now. Yeah. It really is, because Laurie Metcalf had a lot of the independent steam behind her, but now Janney has already won two, and I think that's going to continue.
I think Laurie Metcalf will win the Spirit Award the night before the Oscars.
It could happen.
It was also nice for me to see McKenna Grace, who I liked so much last year in Gifted.
I thought of you, because she's the young
Tanya. She plays young Tanya,
and I thought of Paul Harris. I said, Paul Harris likes this
girl. I like that movie. I just showed that movie to my daughter last weekend, and she loved it, too. Mm. And Sebastian Stan is very good as the slimy Jeff Galooly.
He's phenomenal, yeah.
I realize now that slimy and Galooly are redundant.
Yes. Well, he changed his name because, as he points out in the movie, Galooly became a verb.
Yes.
And so now he's Jeff Stone.
You know who's also very good? Julianne Nicholson, who I've liked in a lot of things, including House of Cards. She plays Tanya's skating coach in this. She's very good. Now, let's talk about the director of this. His name is Craig Gillespie. Last year, or actually in 2016, I praised a movie that he made called Their Finest Hours.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how I praised it. I praised it by putting it on my worst movies of the year list. It deserved enough praise to get it on the top 10 worst movies of 2016.
Ouch.
This time around, he does a better job with the action sequences and the skating scenes. As I mentioned, they look very authentic. Mm-hmm. But I think he gets so much of the rest of the story and the directing of this movie wrong. For example, he fills the soundtrack with tons of songs right out of the Martin Scorsese playbook. But some of them are poorly placed chronologically. For instance, and I'm an old classic rocker, so I notice this stuff. Why are we hearing Chicago's 1971 song 25 or 6-4 in a scene that takes place in 1993? We heard the logical song by Supertramp three times in this movie. Okay, that's from 1980.
It did evoke a very sort of 70s, 80s vibe, where it should have been a 1990s, you know, Boys to Men.
R.E.M.
Kind of, yeah, absolutely. Or anything
Nirvana.
On pop radio at the time, sure.
It's as if he had put his Spotify classic rock playlist on shuffle, and whatever song came up, he put that in the movie.
I will say she skates one time to ZZ Top, and that was an actual
sleeping
routine
bag, yes.
that she used,
right.
So that was accurate.
Okay.
They also, made her a lot more gruff than she was at the time. She has said that she didn't curse out the judges, which is a pretty funny scene, but that didn't happen. And just in general, she was not smoking and cussing as much as they portray her in
says.
Well, again, this is all you can do is go. That's the point of the movie, Paul.
I know.
She says and he says.
One more thing on the music thing.
That's the point.
Craig Gillespie, the director of this movie, uses Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky. I haven't done an official check, but I think it's the 1,000th time that's been in a movie. That should be retired from movie soundtracks forever.
When that song started, I thought, how many more? Yeah. How many more movies do we have to endure this song?
There's actually a list online. If you search Spirit in the Sky movies.
It's ridiculous.
It's dozens.
It's ridiculous.
One thing that Gillespie and his crew got 100% right was the look of the characters, the look of that era in the early 90s. And you can compare his fictionalized versions with the real versions of these people, including Tanya on ice and the idiots who surrounded her in the archival footage that plays during the closing credits. Stick around. If you go see this movie, stick around and see those closing credits. It's worthwhile.
I think not only will Allison Janney have a great chance to win an Oscar, but this also has a great chance in hair and makeup.
Yes.
Because of what you just pointed out.
Yes, although it's going to lose to Darkest Hour.
Darkest Hour, you think so?
Because of Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. And he's been winning a lot of awards lately. Of course, the only reason the movie exists, the only reason we even know Tanya Harding's name now, 20-plus years later, is because of the incident, that January 1994 attack on her rival, Nancy Kerrigan, at the Nationals in Detroit. She was attacked by this lunkhead named Shane Stant, one of several lunkheads who were employed by Sean Eckhart, who was Jeff Galluli's best friend.
Okay, so the actor who plays Sean Eckhart.
Oh, he's perfect.
I have vague recollections of what he looked like and how he acted, because, of course, everybody was on TV back then. It was a giant thing. But I couldn't believe until the actual archival footage at the end how spot on they got this knucklehead.
And he says he's an international terrorist fighter. With who? Well, let's just say
I am. Or
organizations call me and I do that. No, you don't. Yes, I do.
Yes,
no,
I
you
do.
Don't. No.
It was amazing.
Yeah, no credits, but I do. Here's the problem. And this goes back to what I said at the beginning. These lowlifes are portrayed for comedic effect as pure dunces. And that's another bad choice considering the violence against an innocent woman, Nancy Kerrigan. It turned my stomach to see that. And as I said before, I remember a lot of this story.
Oh, sure, me too.
Because I was talking about every detail of it every day on my morning radio show in those days.
Sure.
I was even in the arena in Albertville, France. I was there with the radio station I was working for at the time, doing a week-long live remote from the Coca-Cola Pavilion at the Albertville Olympics in 1992. When Tanya and Nancy and Christy Yamaguchi and Midori Ito and a French woman named Surya Bonaly, I remember like it was yesterday, they all competed, and it was remarkable to be there. But at the time, none of this had happened. None of this stuff that's in the movie, you see her going there, but the attack on Nancy didn't happen until January of 1994, because by then the Olympics had decided we're going to have the Winter Olympics
two years from now. Right.
And we'll switch off every 2 years, summer, winter, summer, winter. That was when they first started that. And on several occasions back then, I discussed all of this with Christine Brennan, the brilliant sports columnist for USA Today, who also has written the definitive book on the ice skaters of that era. And she covered them. And she wrote a column this week about I, Tanya. And I want to share with you what Christine Brennan says. For a quarter of a century now, popular culture has somehow fallen for the notion that Tanya got a raw deal from figure skating judges and the U.S. Figure Skating Association. This is the oxygen on which I, Tanya, survives. Poor Tanya. The bad girl from the wrong side of the tracks got the shaft at every turn. Nice try, but no. U.S. officials didn't send Tanya to one Olympics. They sent her to two. She also won two U.S. national titles, one of which was later taken away due to her supporting role in the attack on Kerrigan. She had given information about Nancy's Cape Cod training rink to the hitmen, and she later pled guilty to the felony of conspiracy to hinder the prosecution. Now, all of that is in the movie, but I'm with Christine that this movie makes it look like, oh, poor Tanya, her circumstances and the people around her, she just couldn't catch a break.
If I'm interviewing Paul Harris and then making a movie based on those interviews, that's the movie that I come up with. Tanya obviously has a poor me attitude.
But Christine was there covering these stories.
This movie is not objective. It's not supposed to be objective. It's based on interviews with Tanya and Jeff.
But it has a viewpoint that is wrong.
Their viewpoint. And I think the point of the movie is to say there's three sides to every story. His side, her side, and the truth.
Last night, ABC had a two-hour special called Tanya Harding, Truth and Lies, which had one great line in it. When Tanya Harding's mother objects and says, "We weren't trailer trash. We lived in a brand new trailer. It was a line that looked like it was scripted for the movie. It was, but that was the real mother saying that. Also, ABC was using reenactments. Why didn't they just show scenes from the movie? There were things that they reenacted actors for this, quote, news special, when they could have used the same scenes from the movie.
But wouldn't they have to license those scenes? I mean,
they showed clips from the movie during the special.
Okay, because the movie is distributed by Neon, yeah, which has nothing to do with ABC or Disney,
right? No, but
right?
They showed clips from the movie, sure, when they were talking about the movie.
But as far as it being a promotional tool, it's not a Disney property.
I just hate reenactments in news stories. The news is supposed to be the truth. Also, in this special last night, they had a man and a woman who run the Tanya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan 1994 Museum.
Which they set up in their bedroom,
It's initially in the hallway of their apartment in Brooklyn, New York. I looked it up. I Googled it last night. I said, there's a museum about these two?
It's a hallway.
It's a hallway with some Wheaties boxes on the wall and some pictures of Nancy.
You said something illuminating here, Paul. You said the news is supposed to be the truth. I, Tanya, the movie, is not supposed to be the truth.
No, this but is this not news, a, no, this no, is not a documentary. ABC special last night was produced by ABC News.
You are angry.
And should not have reenactments.
You are. That's fine, and I can agree with that. I'm not reviewing the special that I didn't watch. I'm reviewing I, Tanya.
I understand.
And this is not a documentary.
I know.
This movie has a point of view. You can't say it's a wrong point of view.
I can.
You can say you didn't like the point of view, but it's based on the person who actually went through it. She could be lying through her teeth, but that's what the movie wanted to present.
If we saw a movie about Charles Manson and it showed us Charles Manson's point of view, seeing himself as a heroic figure, what would you say?
If the movie laid it out the same way this one did, with the initial thing saying this is based on contradictory interviews, as an audience member, I'd be smart enough to not believe everything Charlie Manson said. I'm smart enough to discount a lot of what both Jeff Galluli, who says he never hit her, I don't believe him because I'm smart and I can make up my own mind. I don't need the movie to do anything more than what the movie was trying to do, which is say, these are contradictory, messed up people. Here is their version of the truth. I loved this movie. I know you didn't.
No, this movie was nominated, by the way, for the Critics' Choice Awards. Do you vote in that as a member of the
Broadcast Film Critics Association? I voted on my deadline was Tuesday, so I voted Tuesday.
Did you vote for it for Best Comedy?
I did not.
It was nominated for Best Comedy?
It is in the comedy section, yes.
That's like Get Out being nominated for Best Comedy at the Golden Globes. It's not a comedy, and neither is this.
You didn't laugh once during I, Tanya?
No, I actually kept going like this. Oh, God.
Boy, this is probably the biggest divide on a movie we've had. I love this movie. I thought it was fantastic. The acting's great. I thought it was an ingenious way for them to tell a story that's been contradictory since day one.
You know, I had a guest on last hour who wrote a book about timing. Listen to this timing. Just after the Tanya and Nancy story calmed down in early 1994, you know who took over the headlines? Another athlete by the name of O.J. Simpson, who sucked up all of our air for months and months and months after that. That was one hell of a year. This is not one hell of a movie. I respect a lot of the stuff that's in there, and I think the skating action is good, and I like Margot Robbie, and I think she did a great job in this movie. The acting is fine, but I can only give it a 5 out of 10.
I give I, Tanya an 8 out of 10. I would implore anybody who was either alive back then, who remembered this story, or has been confused about what really happened. There's still people. I mean, Josh Gilbert on Carney's show was saying that he thought Tanya Harding actually took the bat and whapped her knee. So again,
I know.
I love this movie. I give it an 8.
Okay. That's our review of I, Tanya. We've still got two movies to go and lots more showbiz stuff ahead here on the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris here with Max Foyzy talking about showbiz stuff as we do every Friday at this time. Max, our differing views on I, Tanya is not the furthest apart we've ever been. Remember, just a few weeks ago, you hated 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and I called it one of the best movies of the year.
That's true. It's a good point.
And Sam Rockwell's been winning awards for it.
Choice, yeah, last night.
Golden Globe.
Yeah.
So does that put him in the running for Best Supporting Actor?
Boy, you know, I suppose so, and I love Sam Rockwell. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, the Independent Spirit Awards type of nominations, people were talking about Willem Dafoe for Florida Project, but he seems to have lost all kinds of momentum, so maybe it is Rockwell this year. I mean, it would be great if he won.
By the way, Tanya Harding, since the 1994 Olympics, here are some jobs that she had, according to Time Magazine. She did a one-off role in a low-budget action movie called Breakaway in 1996. Then never did another movie. Tells you how well she was received in that. She was on Fox's Celebrity Boxing in 2002. Do you know who she fought?
Paula Jones.
Yes, the woman who had claimed the sexual harassment charges against Bill Clinton. She then went on to a brief career as a professional boxer, calling herself America's Bad Girl. That didn't work out. She lost a fight in 2004, and when she lost that fight, she lost the opportunity to do a pay-per-view special that would have brought her a lot of money.
Huh.
She also did a true TV show called World's Dumbest, which was from our friends at The Smoking Gun, and had other brilliant talent like Gary Busey and Danny Bonaducci.
You know, she was also one of the first celebrities, well, maybe not one of the first celebrities, but recent celebrities to suffer a sex tape leak. It was one of the men's magazines. I don't know if it was Playboy or Penthouse, but they published a bunch of pictures.
Was it Jeff Galluli?
I wonder
who could have released that.
Exactly, yeah. But, I mean, this was before all the Jennifer Lawrence pictures and everything. Of course, in recent times, that happened to her, too, back in 94 or so.
Her publicist dumped her yesterday, a guy named Michael Rosenberg, who's been representing her, well, not for that long, only all the way back to the early 90s. This is the guy who was her publicist during the whole Tanya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing.
Oh, did he drop her yesterday?
Because she demanded that when she talked to a reporter, the reporter be fined $25,000 if the reporter asked about her past. Michael Rosenberg put out a statement saying, "We reached an impasse today regarding how to treat the press. Her adamant and final position is that reporters must sign an affidavit stating they won't ask her anything about the past or they'll be fined $25,000. Obviously, it doesn't work that way. Therefore, I've chosen to terminate our business relationship," unquote.
Wow.
Tanya Harding doesn't want to talk about the past because the future is so bright for her. Next movie we have to review today is The Post, with Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks. You take the lead on this one.
The Post is the next entry into the Ben Bradley cinematic universe. You've heard about it. which now exists, now that Tom Hanks is playing the role that Jason Robards won Best Supporting Actor for All the President's Men. And this really does, Spielberg does a great job. It's directed by Steven Spielberg, dovetailing it into that movie. It really actually does work as sort of a prequel to that movie. And if Tom Hanks is nominated, and if he wins, he would be one of the few actors to win an award for playing the same role, for winning an Oscar. Because the other one, that there's two in history who've done that. The first one that pops into mind is, of course, Vito Corleone, because it was Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And the other one escapes me right now. But if you know, just text in to 84126, because I'm trying to rack my brain right now. But it would be great if that happened with Tom Hanks. This is a true story of the Pentagon Papers and the rise of the Washington Post. I did not know that the Washington Post wasn't always the Washington Post. Of course, it was in the shadow of the Gray Lady, the New York Times, and it was kind of considered a local paper. And, of course, the local paper was read by the people who lived in Washington, and that's a lot of senators and government officials. But it was a sort of a family paper, and when the publisher died, he left the paper to his wife, who's played here by Meryl Streep. She doesn't really know what to do with the paper. She hopes to stay afloat, but she doesn't really know how to make that work. She decides to take it public, although the board of directors is worried that they're, again, going to be eclipsed by the New York Times.
Did Jeff Bridges win for playing Rooster Cogburn in True Grit?
No.
Okay, he was nominated, though, right?
I don't know if he was nominated for that one. He won for Crazy Heart.
Okay.
It's pretty good trivia, right? Because I think there's only two actors who've ever won for the playing the same fictional character.
Okay.
So the New York Times gets its hands on the Pentagon Papers, which was a government report, the look on how we were doing in the Vietnam War, and it had been over many, many years, and it was basically a bunch of evidence that we were doing horribly and we were losing, and we didn't want to pull out of the war because we didn't want to have egg on our face.
And the government had been lying to us for years.
For years, all the way back to Kennedy, before Kennedy. It was Republicans, it was Democrats. We were lying about being interested in Vietnam, about trying to stabilize it, about trying to go over there. And so the American public had been lied to for decades. And now we were very scared to leave the war because we didn't want to be failures, because we had, up to that point, not lost a war.
We had to have peace with honor, as Nixon said.
Exactly. and so there was a person who stole these government secrets, basically, and gave them to the New York Times.
Daniel Ellsberg.
That published them, and it caused a national scandal, and Nixon flipped out and had a federal judge bar them from publishing any more secrets, saying it was national security. This went all the way up to the Supreme Court, where they had to decide, is this freedom of the press or is this national security? In the meantime, Ben Bradley has to think, well, what can we do here? The New York Times was barred, but we are not over here at the Washington Post. We need to get our hands on these papers. We need to publish them. It was kind of reminds me of our current climate, where President Trump can say, ABC, you're not allowed in here. And then Fox News goes, that's not very cool. Even though they're competitors, they're still all members of the press. Mm-hmm. And this is what happened, is the Washington Post said, you know what, we might go to jail, we might be in contempt, but we're going to publish this too. And
not only did they have to worry about that pressure from and threats from the administration, they also had to worry at the same time about the IPO. The Washington Post was a private, family-run company that was going public at the time, and there were concerns about what would their institutional investors say if they were sued by the federal government for publishing the Pentagon Papers. And Katharine Graham had to deal with that, too.
A lot of the tension in the film is the will they or won't they publish these papers. There's also actually finding this source, and that is laid at the feet of Bob Odenkirk, who you will know from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. He was back on Mr. Show, and he's great in this role. It's one of my favorite things he's ever done. He gets the source, he gets the papers, he actually flies them back to their offices, and when the stewardess says, excuse me, what do you have there? He says, government secrets. And it's a great line, because they're government secrets.
That's right.
Of course, you know, there's no real spoilers here, because this is all history, but watching Tom Hanks and watching Meryl Streep and Bob Odenkirk sort of come together and go to this very frightening place in the name of patriotism is extraordinary. And Steven Spielberg, he's making the kinds of movies now that he was accused of killing back in the 70s and 80s.
Like this and Bridge of Spies?
Yes. Well, when All the President's Men was coming out, he was doing stuff like Close Encounters and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the establishment said, who's this young pop artist guy? Now he's doing stuff like Bridge of Spies and The Post, and he's just so good at it.
Yep. I want to point out one other thing about the Katharine Graham character, who's played, as always, brilliantly by Meryl Streep. She's incapable of a bad performance. What you see in this movie is also that she was from a much higher social status than everybody else. This is a woman who, because of the money in the family and the history of the Grahams, she hung out with the Kennedys and LBJ and his wife, and later on the Reagans. And there's a scene in the movie where she has a party at her house, and Robert McNamara is there because he's a good friend of hers. He was the Secretary of Defense at the time, and he's the guy who was most at risk because of the things that were said in the Pentagon Papers, and she's there, and she tells him, look, we have to publish this.
Well, she has to make a choice to either be a newspaper publisher or be his friend.
Or be a society lady.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's very, very good. Also, you mentioned Bob Odenkirk, who I read today has signed on for an action movie called Nobody. Have you heard about this?
I have not.
He plays, it says, a regular guy pushed too far, leaving him with no choice but to loudly scream the F-bomb and then presumably beat the crap out of a bunch of bad guys, which reminds me of a Michael Douglas movie called Falling Down.
Yes, you're right.
I hope it's not as cheesy as that was.
That's like a bad ending, too.
But in addition to Bob Odenkirk, you get Bradley Whitford, Sarah Paulson, Allison Brie, Carrie Coon, Jesse Plemons, Tracy Letts, David Cross, Michael Stuhlbarg, and Zach Woods.
Every single one of those people, I was like, is that Tracy Letts? That's Allison Brie. Wait a minute. Is that Michael Stuhlbarg? It took me a minute.
Maybe the best movie ensemble of the year. Now, do you think this is as good as All the President's Men?
No, I don't. And I don't know. That one ratchets up the tension after a while. It's got a slow start. This one also has a slow start. It's got a very odd beginning. I was watching the screener, and my wife said, did you start this at the beginning? Because we thought the opening was so strange.
Yeah.
It takes a while to get going. And I do think, unfortunately, it has a little bit of that take-your-medicine kind of go-to-school vibe. I've, you know, McGraw-Milhaven was saying that this should be shown in schools. And I could see if you have a substitute teacher one day and she wants to have movie day, she might put this on. It does have that bit of, you know, oh, Lord.
Yeah, but it also makes it seem like the Post was the hero here. And it's actually the New York Times that deserves that credit because they were the ones who broke it and got it first and studied it and did all that stuff. Not that the Post didn't do something good.
Sure.
But you got to give it, you know, the Post got the silver medal here.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Post, yes, the Post had to decide, are we going to put our necks out there like the Times already has? And of course, it's good for America that they did.
Yeah.
Also, there's a lot of hay being made that this is a response to Donald Trump. I don't think that's the case.
No.
I think that no matter who our president is in 20 years, 30 years, freedom of the press is still going to be important.
Here's how you know this was not a movie made just because of the Trump presidency. The movie was written 3 years ago by a newcomer named Liz Hanna as a spec script that she sent to Steven Spielberg, who liked it so much while Obama was still president that he bought the rights to it from her and brought in Josh Singer, who wrote another great newspaper movie called Spotlight, which won the Oscar for Best Picture a couple of years ago, brought him in. He did some punch up on it. But what you see on the screen is mostly Liz Hanna's original script from 3 years ago, not from 2017. So I think that that criticism is absolutely wrong. I also don't think this is as good a movie as Spotlight.
No, it's not.
And it's not up there with All the President's Men.
No.
Frankly, it's not even as good as The Paper, the Ron Howard movie with Michael Keaton and Marissa Tomei and all the rest.
This is the definition of a movie that you appreciate a lot more than actually enjoy.
I will say this. As our modern history echoes the past, this is, and here's my quote for the movie little poster. This is a still necessary lesson in the power of the press to keep government in check. It is a cautionary tale of how lies told by the most powerful people in our nation can lead us down a dangerous and deadly path if not dragged out into public view. That is the Post. I give it an 8.5. What do you give it?
I will give the Post a 7.5. Meaning, yes, it's a half point lower than I, Tanya. Also, if I may, Bob Odenkirk, I had the great pleasure of speaking to him today, and he'll be on the movie show tomorrow night. The show broadcasts here on KTRS from 9 p.m. until 11 p.m. We have 2 hours. And if you miss that, that's fine. Go to KTRS.com, look for the Maxim Movies page, and you'll be able to hear my interview with Saul himself, Bob Odenkirk.
When we come back, another big movie opening this weekend called The Commuter, starring Liam Neeson. Was that worth it? We'll tell you right after this. It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris, Max Boise, talking movies in our showbiz show this hour. Next hour on the Harris Challenge, everybody who gets on the air and plays will get tickets to the new Daniel Day-Lewis movie, Phantom Thread, which was written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. That opens in St. Louis today. So does Paddington 2, and so does Proud Mary, in which Taraji P. Henson from Empire and Hidden Figures plays a hit woman with the Boston mob.
I'm surprised that one hasn't gotten more promotion.
Was there a screening for us?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so either. The third movie we have to talk about today is called The Commuter. I will say this. When I walked out of the packed screening that Max and I both attended a few nights ago, this is Liam Neeson's latest action movie. When I walked out of The Commuter, there were two groups of people in the lobby. One was regular people buzzing with excitement about what they just seen. The other was a group of critics grousing about having to sit through it. And that's because the latter group, I think, went in with their expectations bar set too high. Maybe it's because you've been exposed to so many awards contenders in the last few weeks, and you're thinking only about high-class, award-worthy movies. The non-critics and I went in hoping for a fun popcorn movie and nothing more, and Max, that's exactly what we got.
Yeah, true. It does not aim high.
And that's fine.
It barely aims at all.
But that's fine. Let me say this. At 65 years old, Liam Neeson has probably reached the age where he should stop making movies like this.
And I think he has announced this is his last big action-adventure movie. He wants to go back to doing character work.
Who does he think he is, Harrison Ford? But I will say in this, he is still believable as the character he's been playing for years now, the everyman who gets caught up in a situation beyond his control. This time he plays Michael McCauley, who's an ex-cop who, for the last decade, has been commuting by train to his job in Midtown Manhattan from the suburbs to be an insurance salesman, and it's the same routine every day until he's called into the boss's office and unceremoniously fired. He decides not to tell his wife over the phone. He goes to a local bar. He commiserates over a couple of beers with his former police partner, Patrick Wilson. Then he gets on the train home, and on the train, he's approached by a woman he's never met before, who's played by Vera Farmiga, who, by the way, should be getting better roles by now. I thought after Up in the Air, she'd be getting better roles.
She's great.
She engages him in small talk and then asks him this hypothetical question. Would you carry out a single act that has no effect on you and only has ramifications for a stranger for a $100,000 payoff?
It's the same setup as The Button, the old Twilight Zone episode, which is based on, I think it's a Richard Matheson story called Button Button.
Yes.
Which is, will you press a button if somebody who you don't know around the world will die and you get a bunch of money?
$1 million when they made it into a movie.
Sure. Which was called The Box with Cameron Diaz.
Correct. Well, Michael's just lost his job. And he has to pay not only his mortgage and his bills, but his son's upcoming college tuition. So he's intrigued by the thought of $100,000 until he finds out that the question wasn't so hypothetical. He is caught up in something very dangerous and lives are on the line. I'm not going to give away any more of the plot. I will say the premise may be thin, but it is enough to draw us in. And Liam Neeson pulls out his usual combination of bravery and brains. That's his thing over the last several movies, all the way back to Taken 1. And he also has to figure out what's really going on and eyeing everybody else on the commuter train and all that sort of stuff. Now, the director of this movie is the same guy who made a movie I really liked in 2016 called The Shallows.
It's probably his most well-received film.
Yeah, Blake Lively versus a shark.
Yeah, he also directed Orphan, which starred Vera Farmiga, and Four with Liam Neeson, now Unknown, Nonstop, Run All Night, and now The Commuter.
In this movie, I think he keeps the suspense taut, although there are several sequences that are tough to accept. For instance, in one fight, a woman sprays mace in his face, and 2 seconds later, he's fine. And there are no after effects. Now, have you ever been sprayed in the face with mace?
Thankfully, no.
Either have I. But I'm guessing that you don't recover in 2 seconds and just go on with your life in the same way that all these action movies have hand-to-hand brawls and somebody ends up getting kicked in the mahungalulus and they still come back and fight some more. They don't go on the floor and writhe in pain for about a half hour like a human male would.
Last year, there was another thriller based on a train, the newest version of Murder on the Orient Express, which was directed by Ken Branagh and starred Ken Branagh.
Yes.
Same kind of thing. He's walking through from train car to train car, eyeing everybody.
Yes.
You don't get a lot of character development. They're all just sort of archetypes.
Right.
Same thing here, although one of these movies was really classy and I had a lot of fun with it, and the other one was just ridiculously bad. I hated The Commuter.
Okay, I hated Murder on the Orient Express.
Really? I had fun with that.
No.
It'll kill
me. Here's why I like this one. I was willing to suspend disbelief and go along for the ride. I know that in movie fights like this, there are going to be enough punches and kicks to disable a normal human being, but not our hero. You know what it reminded me of, Max? Not the first Die Hard, not the second Die Hard, but Die Hard 3, the one with Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson.
Right, with the vengeance.
Ridiculous situations. He comes shooting up out of the tunnel on that water, and he lands, and he's fine, and all that sort of stuff. You just have to suspend disbelief, just like you do for any other movie in this genre.
But I didn't... Okay, Liam Neeson's character, I think, was the worst ex-cop ever. I was happy he was no longer a cop, because I thought he was just being creepy to everybody. I was never really rooting for him.
Okay.
He was very selfish, trying to find out who this mystery person named Prin was, which, by the way, is way too easy to figure out. But he was trying to figure this out so he could get a bunch of money.
I didn't figure it out.
You didn't figure it out?
No. Here's who I felt sorry for in this movie. Jonathan Banks, who's in there with a role that's way too small for him, and Elizabeth McGovern, who is given the thankless role of playing Liam Neeson's barely seen wife.
It's good to see her on screen, though.
And Sam Neill, let me ask you this. Do you think there was more to the Sam Neill character's plot cut out and ended up on the cutting room floor?
He shows up in the beginning and kind of like stares into the audience, and he never really comes back. It was very, very strange. I could suspend my disbelief for movies like Nonstop and Unknown, which were by the same creative team.
Yeah.
I actually like those movies a bit. The Commuter was a huge letdown for me. The guitar scene, he takes a guitar
and he starts
if you love Liam Neeson, if you like action films, I still wouldn't recommend The Commuter.
Okay.
What a letdown.
I think if you keep your expectations low And you don't question how Vera Farmiga's character knows everything that happens on the train after she gets off.
True, they never explain that.
It's not horrible. It's not great. It's probably not going to do a lot at the box office, but I bet it lives on cable and streaming services for a long time to come. People are going to watch this movie at home, even if they won't pay to go see it in the movie theaters. I give it a 6.5.
Oh, my Lord. What did you give I, Tonya?
Five. Yes.
Wow.
Because I had different expectations for these movies.
I give The Commuter a 2. A 2.
Okay. You know, if I have, or if I go into a store and I get generic brand potato chips, I don't expect Ruffles.
I like B movies, but I didn't like this B movie. Also, earlier I was saying that there were two actors who've won Academy Awards for playing the same fictional character, but apparently I'm wrong. We've Googled this the last couple of breaks, and we can't come up with anybody. Somebody texted in Robert Redford, but no, that wouldn't make any sense.
No.
So it might just be the character of The Godfather that was played by De Niro and Brando.
Vito Corleone. When we come back after the news and all the other information at the top of the hour, it's time to play the Harris Challenge, and we'll have tickets for that new Daniel Day-Lewis movie for everyone who gets on the air. Don't call yet. I'll tell you when. Stand by for your topical trivia challenge, the Harris Challenge, coming up on the Big 550 KTRS.